Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, August 4th. I'm Ray Graff. It is that time once again when we welcome Bob Berman to our airwaves. Bob is one of the most well-known astronomers in the whole wide world. His most recent book is Beyond Biocentrism, Rethinking Space-Time Consciousness and the Illusion of Death. He wrote that with Robert Lanza, M.D. It's always great to have Bob on the program. Always a popular guest he is, so I suggest you get in early. We could talk about the Perseid meteor shower or anything you want to talk about, literally under the sun or beyond. 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Bob Berman and your calls, comments, tweets, and more coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome back renowned astronomer Bob Berman to the studio to field all of your questions. He is one of the best-known and most widely read astronomers in the whole world. His most recent book is Beyond Biocentrism. And there's a long addendum to that, which I wrote down and now lost. It's Beyond
Space-Time Consciousness and the Illusion of Death.
The Illusion of Death. I haven't gotten to that part yet. I'm about halfway through the book. And Bob is here to answer your questions about his book or the coming Perseid meteor shower or anything you want. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. You can also email the program, voxpop@wamc.org, or tweet us at WAMCVoxPop. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, welcome back.
Thank you, Ray. Great to be here.
So the meteor shower next week, right? Or is it this week?
No, it's Thursday and Friday. We get a twofer this year, two nights.
A week from today?
Yes.
Okay. And this is usually a pretty good one, right?
It's the year's best or second best. This year, it's going to be the best.
Really? Yeah. Well, now, how do you know that with such certainty?
Because of the moon. The moon interferes. Many of the meteors are only medium bright or even a little less than medium. So if there's a bright sky behind it, you just don't see them. So either being in the city or bright towns or bright suburbs or bright moonlight makes it so that you just see a few of them. And this year, the moon is not too bad for the Perseids, but will really be terrible for the Geminids on December 13th. That's usually the best shower, but not this year.
So the moon is a key factor. Is the relative number of meteors the same every year?
Yeah, pretty much so. You do get better years and worse years, but pretty much there's one a minute in these Perseids. And because it's summertime, unlike the Geminids, who's really going to go out in the middle of December to look around? It's just the perfect time of year. And everybody remembers them from summer camp or from vacations in the country. And this year, I think maybe what we'll do is give some tips for how to see them.
Okay.
Best.
Look up.
Well,
right?
Yeah. Look up. But you want a clear patch of sky. You want to be out in the open. You don't want to be looking between buildings or between trees. Secondly, there's a huge increase in their number after 12 or 1 o'clock. So if you're really serious about this and want to see one or two every minute, you want to be observing at 2, 3, 4 a.m., not 9, 10, 11 p.m. And this year, the moon, which is not a full moon, but it's not dim either, sets at 1 a.m. on Thursday night and 2 a.m. on Friday night. So you get a double benefit by going out after 1 or 2 a.m. You get no moon in the sky, darkens the sky, more meteors. And secondly, the meteors increase dramatically in their number anyway. So if you're serious, get out on the wee hours, set the alarm. And if you just want to see some, you'll see some no matter when you look.
In the moments prior to the show, you said the origin, the place where these Perseids begin or came from, is the most dangerous spot in the universe or the solar system? What do you mean?
It's every meteor shower presents objects that are breakaway fragments from comets. We were a little uncertain about the Geminids. There's an odd object called Phaethon that's more of an asteroid than a comet that produces those. And we could talk about that, but this is not those. So let's just say, by and large, almost exclusively, they're all comet fragments. So what's the parent body of this one? In some cases, it's a famous comet like Comet Halley.
Right.
But in this case, It was an odd comet discovered by two Civil War astronomers, Lewis Swift and Horace Tuttle, in 1862.
Oh.
They found, and that's why it's called Comet Swift-Tuttle, they found a comet that returns every 133 years. Okay, fair enough. And the orbit of that comet was found to be identical to the paths of all of these meteoroids that hit Earth. This shower has been noticed since the time of the ancient Chinese, thousands of years. But they're on identical paths. So we know this comes from that comet. Now, here's where it gets interesting. That comet has a path that can carry it so close to Earth. For example, in the year, I think it's 4492. In any case, it's the 4000s. It'll be so close, it'll barely be farther away than the moon.
Huh.
And it does have a path that intercepts us. So sooner or later, we think, we're safe for the next few millennia, but sooner or later, we're going to collide with it. And this comet happens to travel at a very high speed. It's not a normal speed. It's 38 miles per second, because that's also the speed of these meteoroids. And it's got a giant nucleus, 15 miles across, bigger than most. And the combination of that, it's calculated, would produce an impact event, an explosion, with more energy, 27 times more energy than the event that killed all the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. And so this comet is categorized as the most hazardous known object in the universe so far as Earth is concerned.
Well, I thought Swift-Tuttle crashed into Jupiter. Am I wrong?
No, that was Comet Shoemaker-Levy.
Ah, okay, another hyphenated name. Okay.
Yeah, whenever you get two people who discover them, as we had with Hale Bopp back in 1995, you have to share it.
Okay, fair enough. But, you know, by the year 4000, or whenever it will make a pass within the distance of the Earth to the moon, how much left will there be? In other words, isn't it shedding material whenever we see meteor showers?
Oh, you're so right. And every meteor shower, you know, is something that the comet lost. Plus, every time it goes around the sun, when it comes close enough to the sun, steam and vapor actually escape from the comet. So it loses mass. But since it's only 133 years every trip, it's not that much per trip, and there'll still be plenty left for whenever it collides with us.
All right, this one came in via email. And once again, the number here is 800-348-2551 if you have a question for Bob Berman. And an email came in prior to the show beginning. Bob, this one's from Susan in New Lebanon. Says, lately it seems the aurora have been more active, registering active or highly active on the scale used by the GI in Alaska, but I have not seen any from our Columbia County spot in almost 20 years, even when I go to a very dark spot with good northern views. For example, last night, the website, I guess the GI website, showed a level 5 and indicated aurora possibly visible as far south as Boston. The night before, a level 6 visible as far south as Annapolis. Are the aurora that elusive or few and far between that I never see them, even with levels that high? The graphic one-hour map showed wide green visible areas with some yellows but no red. And then she asks, so do I have to go to Alaska to see an aurora or what?
Yeah. Come to Alaska with us. Look up Berman Astronomy Tours. Join us. We've been doing this for 20 years. We've never, and this is knock on wood because someday I'm going to curse myself by saying this, but we've never yet had a group. You should do it, Ray, and bring all those kids.
I've seen aurora right in dear it's old Del Mar, New York.
And you can see them from here, and they can be great from here. But there's nothing like the all-sky auroras that you get from Central Alaska. We have our secret places, too, that we go every year. So, yeah, as long as this caller brought up coming to Alaska, sure, join us. We do this every February or March. But, okay, you want to see it here.
Yes.
The last good auroras here were in the fall of 2000 and again in the fall of 2001. So we've really been suffering from a lack of them. And like this caller, I'm checking it a lot. I'm looking outside a lot. You're right, that last level six aurora is unbelievably rare. And that means that if you look to the northern sky, you well could have seen one, but we didn't.
Yes.
Because they're just too low from here. Now, that doesn't mean we don't get all sky views we did on March 13th, 1989. We had an aurora that filled the whole sky. In fact, it knocked a quarter of Canada into darkness. Remember that?
Yes.
Because it blew up transformers.
Now, was that at the height of a sunspot cycle?
No, and very often they're not. We can get anomalies, just like these great ones we've had in the last couple of years. At least you're in Alaska, would have been great. We're now past the peak of the sunspot cycle, and yet we're still getting them. It's a funny way this works. And even when the sun is most active and producing all this stuff, galactic cosmic rays are least active because the sun serves as a football blocker that channels the most powerful cosmic rays away from us. So there's kind of a paradox there that when the sun gets wimpy around the time of its minimum coming up in a few years, that's when galactic cosmic rays are free to come in and they produce more genetic damage in our bodies and more effect sometimes than you would get even from the sun. So it's like you can't win.
You can't win. Now, at what height are the auroras produced? What altitude?
Typically 80 miles or so, 100 miles.
I was reading, vacation reading, insane, but I was reading about high-altitude nuclear tests, and they did a whole series of them, higher and higher. I think 250 miles might have been about the
Isn't
highest.
Isn't that terrible that they did that?
And but they created auroras.
That's right. And they also put 50 tons of carbon-14 into the atmosphere, 50 tons more than we normally have, so that the people whose teeth were developing at that time in the 1950s, I suspect yours.
No,
perhaps.
I was born in 1964.
Well, okay. Well, you had teeth developing then by the late 50s.
What?
The test ban treaty didn't go into effect, what was that, in 1957 or 1958? So you had teeth forming.
I was born in 1964.
Oh, 64. Yeah. I didn't hear that.
So I thought this was one of those time things your book.
No, it's just my hearing going.
All right, my head is spinning.
So it's not your teeth. It's more like my teeth. And anybody whose teeth were forming in the 50s actually have so much more radiation trapped in their teeth from those nuclear tests that they can tell if you were developing at that time by measuring your teeth's radiation.
Huh. We'll talk more Atom Age dentistry with the Bob Berman in a moment.
Support comes from Mannix Marketing, Glens Falls, New York. Since 1996, a web design and internet marketing firm working to help businesses get found on the internet. Mannixmarketing.com. George Heigl, Cowen's representative, specializing in evaluating, marketing, buying, and selling of jewelry, fine art, historic firearms, American Indian art, and more. 518-396-7974. The Lathrop Communities, serving older adults in the Quaker tradition for over 25 years, independent living in Northampton and East Hampton, Massachusetts, in the heart of the Pioneer Valley. Lathrop.kendall.org. The Nature Conservancy's Adirondack Chapter, working to preserve freshwater resources that flow from the Adirondacks to New York's urban centers, nature.org/Adirondacks. And Chester Wood presents The Nature of Glass, an outdoor contemporary sculpture exhibition curated by Jim Shantz, featuring artists incorporating glass in their sculptural works. Chesterwood.org for details.
Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call and talk show. The number here is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. Bob, we've been chatting away here, and people are waiting online, so let's get right into the queue and go to John and Canaan. John, you're on. Or not. Oh, let's pot him up. Hang on.
This is a repeat of a question that I asked you previously, but I didn't get the answer to it because the phone was cut off before you were able to finish what you were saying. So essentially it has to do with your latest book, Beyond Biocentrism. And it's my continued question that I don't understand the explanation for the fact that there are many, many evidences of the existence of the Earth and life on the Earth prior to the appearance of consciousness on Earth. So it seems to me that presents a dilemma for the argument that's presented in the book. And I'd be very glad if you could help me understand why it's not a dilemma.
Okay, I'll try. And I'll only be partially successful because even Bob Lanza and I writing the book, and if you read the book, you know that there's a chapter in the end where we say that paradoxes remain, and they're not just little paradoxes, they're huge paradoxes, they're contradictions.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that all we're asking is, does this better fit the evidence of the science of the last 50 years or so? Not that it resolves all questions. So I'm not going to resolve everything, but here it goes. First of all, you said that there's life before there's consciousness. I'm not sure at all that you can have life without consciousness, because none of us know whether grass or moss or anything, whether there's really life without consciousness or whether they're one with each other. But since you can't answer that, let's skip to the next part of what you're saying. Essentially, yes, we can see things like light arriving from distant stars, and obviously these photons left before there was life on Earth. And because right. One of the central theses in the book is that consciousness is correlative with the universe. There really is no universe without consciousness. They're one and the same. How can you possibly resolve that? Now, one way, not maybe completely satisfactorily, but one way is that we say that everything, and this is John Wheeler's idea too, and remember, he's a renowned physicist, or was, he just passed away a few years ago, that you simply don't have any reality without an observation. He said no phenomenon is a real phenomenon unless it's an observed phenomenon. So even these photons that we're measuring now that came from stars billions of light years away before there was ever consciousness on Earth, we would say that the reality of these photons even coming into existence to be measured are only happening in the here and now by consciousness, in the form of consciousness. And without our present consciousness, there were no photons en route beforehand, because there really is no time. And remember, we devote at least four chapters to time.
Yes.
That time is not a real independent thing. So the moment, and you're absolutely reasonable, caller Joe, John? I'm sorry.
What was John, yes.
John. To think of objects in existence before there were observers is wrong to begin with, because time is not a real thing like a quartz crystal or a jar of mayonnaise or something. It does not have existence until there is a consciousness that's ordering the events and giving it existence. So when we try with our minds to say, okay, well, here are things that are happening beforehand, before there were ever observers, that's an imaginary, fictitious viewpoint to begin with,
okay,
even
John,
though it doesn't seem to be.
John, we have to let you go, but thank you very much for the call. Well, a senior member of the newsroom posed this question for you. Okay, my refrigerator's not there when I'm not there to view it. How come when I get home from work, the milk is still cold?
Because all of the atoms, all of the electrons, all of the subatomic particles in this 10 to the 80th power of them in the universe exist in states of probability, what John Bell in his work in the 1960s would say a wave function. It's sort of like a blurry probabilistic state. And every object upon observation will collapse upon observation from its probabilistic state to an actual state. And there's a different probability of it being here, and another lesser probability of it being here instead, and another probability of it being there. And the bottom line is that there's an overwhelming probability that all the atoms required for that container of milk in the refrigerator will still collapse into the to form the wave functions that they did when you last put them in the shelf. However, and no physicist doubts this, by the way, there is a non-zero chance that all of them will reform in a different place, and that milk container won't be there, but instead will be in, let's say, a refrigerator in the White House instead. And every physicist will say, yes, that's possible. So the mere fact that that's possible, not impossible, answers the question of this anonymous person here at the studio.
Is there any greater than zero chance it'll turn into a gin and tonic? Because that would be a trick. Now, then you got physics. Let's go to Malcolm in Amherst. Malcolm, you're on.
Good afternoon, fellows. Wow, so many questions that last one just brought up. I almost want to go there. But originally my focus was going to be on this, kind of needling in on the idea of wave collapse being observation versus interactions being able to cause wave collapse. So I'm kind of getting at, you know, getting back to maybe it doesn't take a conscious observation as much as the same interactions that seem to be driving time, which is basically atomic, the atoms themselves, the forces within and their actions are basically what's driving time forward. So, you know, that same thing is causing things to interact all around us. So, as I used to tell my kids when you first came out with some of this stuff, you know, that signpost over there, kids, you know, when no one's around, you know, the question is it, you know, really there? Are the atoms manifest? Have the waves collapsed? Well, my premise is, well, of course they have, because they're interacting with the stuff around them.
You know, you're bringing up great points, and physicists are still debating and planning experiments to figure out why this happens. These days, the biggest head scratcher is, how do you go from the quantum world, where things can be essentially existing in two simultaneous existences, you know, Schrodinger's cat,
yeah,
alive and dead at the same time, and upon observation, the cat's either dead or alive. How do you go from the world of the tiny, where that exists, to the classical world of physics, where things are in one place but not another? A baseball flying through the air, it's here, but it's not there.
That brings up another part, like something but, else, just if I could briefly, is that in terms of, there's also, and I haven't actually read your book, I will admit, but as far as a lot of the things I've also been reading about, the ideas behind, you know, kind of the beyond life and death thing, is the idea that if there's all these quantum possibilities, that there are realities out there, universes say, that have to exist in a sense because of some infinite quantum, you know, possibilities.
No, we deal with that in one chapter, the multiverse thing and everything. No, you have to read the book, because I can't do it justice in a few sentences here, and that will make it, I mean, this is years of work, and it'll make it clear as a bell there. In any case, just to answer your first question, what is it that makes that leap from the quantum laws to the classical laws of physics? Is it just observation? Could it be something else, like being in a gravitational field? You mentioned interactions with each other, and there are studies underway. I have a friend who's actually training a dog so that in the double slit experiment, the dog can recognize the two patterns, and we'll see whether that transition happens, whether there's
can
an
I
effect.
I'd love to help with some of this kind of stuff. Wow.
All right. Well, Malcolm, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. You know, in your book, you make a great point about the classical Greek physics and how they had many things. They were on the right track, but yet they still had to deal with the image of the gods above walking around and overseeing everything and trying to rectify what they can measure with what they believe or were taught to believe. And you also brought up how perhaps what you guys are writing about in this book may be a little closer to Hindu and Buddhist cosmology. And we got this email from Michelle from Phoenicia, and I have no idea if Michelle read your book, but I'll read. It's a fairly long email, but here we go. Bob, what you are describing when you speak of the concept of infinity of the universe is a basic tenet of Hindu and Buddhist cosmology, expressed as the diamond net of Indra, which illustrates the interpenetration, intercausality, and interbeing of all things. The world of Indra is a vast net of jewels stretching infinitely in all directions, and each nexus of the net is a single brilliant perfect jewel. Each jewel reflects every other jewel, infinite in number, and each of the reflected images of the jewels bears the image of all the other jewels, infinity to infinity. Whatever affects one jewel affects all.
You have to read the book.
That's all you got?
Yeah, because these things and the connection with Eastern thought and classical Eastern thought are so explored in such detail, and I it sounds okay. Like I'm patting myself on the back with such clarity that whatever few mumbling sentences I do to try to answer her is not going to do justice.
All right, well, here's the last two sentences from Michelle. The metaphor illustrates the interpenetration of all phenomena. Everything contains everything else. At the same time, each individual thing is not hindered by any individual thing. And that's from Michelle from Phoenicia, and we appreciate that. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org, and the number is 800-348-2551. Casey in Saratoga is next. Casey.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'll take it easy on your brain here for a second.
Cool, man.
I'm just trying to get into some astronomy and everything, and I got a telescope as a gift, and I pretty quickly threw it way out of alignment, and I'm wondering if you know any contacts with people around who might do repair or at least service of some sort.
You're in Phoenicia?
No, Saratoga.
Saratoga. Oh, if you were closer, where did I come up with Phoenicia? If you were closer, I do that on occasion for people. Call your local astronomy club. Albany certainly has one, and there will be people there that can help you with it. Or feel free to contact me, SkymanBob@AOL.com, and ask me some basic questions.
SkymanBob?
Yeah.
And SkymanBob.
I never give my address over the air, first time ever, but
No worries.
Do that, and I'll see if I can give you some direct advice with that. And we'll see what you mean by collimation. Do you mean that mirror is off, or do you mean that the finder scope is not aligned with the main scope?
I think both.
Okay, I'll tell you how to do that. That's pretty quick.
All right, well, thanks, Casey. We appreciate the call. Let's go up to lovely Keene, New Hampshire. Steve. Steve, you got to turn your radio down, man. You got to turn that thing right on down. Oh, Steve and Keene. All right. All right, we can't do it. We can't do it. Sorry, Steve and Keene, New Hampshire. You got to have your radio down or else it's an endless feedback loop. It's Einstein. Let's go to Leo in Greenfield. Leo.
Yes, I have a question about centripetal force. As an ice skater is spinning and then brings his or her arms in, they increase their speed immensely. Now, a star or star systems, they revolve, and as it accretes material and turns into a black hole, into a pinprick of matter, it seems to me that centrifugal force would be so immense because it would speed up and just blow itself up on a flat plane. I can't get this through my head, and I'm sure you've got an answer that probably won't get there either. But
well, you're absolutely right. And by centrifugal force, which, by the way, doesn't really exist, people think of angular momentum or inertia. There's no real force called centrifugal force, but you're right. You throw a blob of jello onto a turntable, and you turn up, if it's got the old kind like what Ray has, that can play 78 RPM records, a fast-moving turntable, you find the jello like going in all directions. Centrifugal force is throwing it outward. So I think what you're saying is, as a star collapses, it always speeds up, just as the ice skater does when he or she pulls in her arms, which is why neutron stars spin so quickly. Oddly enough, though, white dwarfs do not spin very quickly.
Why is that?
Even though they're collapsed stars. They're apparently generating enough of a magnetic field that they're losing some of their spin force just to frame dragging, and just the magnetic field is helping them dissipate that. But in general, as things get smaller and smaller, they go faster and faster and faster. I think the caller's question is, if that's the case, why don't objects go so fast that they just break apart? And the truth is, there are stars like that, like Vega, the brightest star, blue, beautiful overhead star, brightest star closest to overhead these nights, is spinning so quickly, in less than a day, our sun takes a month to make a spin, that it's only about 18% below the speed in which it'll break itself to pieces.
Yeah.
So you do have that effect where there's a danger. However, you have the contrary and contradicting effect that objects get so such strong gravitational fields as they're collapsing, it's so condensed that it becomes harder for the mass to escape from it.
Yeah.
And that generally wins out and prevents the thing from breaking up.
Leo, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Bob Berman is the guest. 800-348-2551. So you mentioned neutron stars spinning fast. And was it the early 60s when quasars were discovered?
Yes, yes.
And is that the same effect that we're seeing?
Quasars not, but in neutron stars, for example, the Crab pulsar, it spins 33 times in a second. Here's a star spinning 33 times in a second, and it started out with a star somewhat heavier than the sun. So you can get fantastic spin rates. There's one that spins 700 and something times a second.
That's
so
fast.
You get really fantastic speeds with those kind of stars, neutron stars.
So what exactly is a quasar? I know that when they were first discovered, someone said, oh, my gosh, this is a regular pulse of energy. We've found intelligent signals from space.
Right, so what is,
in fact, a quasar?
Yes. Well, that was Jocelyn Bell who first discovered it. She was working with Anthony Hewish in England. And he got all the credit. She got no credit for being the first to discover rapidly spinning objects of this type. Quasi-stellar objects, though, are or QSOs or quasars. They were called quasi or quasi-stellar because they look like pinpoints of light.
Yeah, they're very bright.
They're in the center of galaxies, and there are none around here. And they're avoiding this part of the universe. So why are they avoiding our region where we have to look to distant places to study them? It turns out they're not avoiding our place. They're avoiding our time. They existed in the early universe. They don't exist anymore anywhere.
What are they?
And they are the cores, the extremely massive, dense cores of early galaxies that are giving off as much brilliance is sometimes the entire rest of the galaxy, usually in all parts of the spectrum, visible and invisible at once. And because of this high energy concentrated into a small little place, it lets us see early galaxies. We still see them out to billions of light years away, where sometimes we wouldn't catch any glimpse of the rest of the galaxy.
Huh. Very interesting. Bob Berman is our guest. The number to call is 800-348-2551. Wow, a fast hour, and we're hitting the home stretch. We'll do that after this break.
Support comes from NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com. Sheehy Opticians, Albany, New York, providing eyeglasses, including Bevel, LaFont, and Pro Design, progressive lenses from Verilux and Nikon, and Maui Jim, Costa, and Ray-Ban sunglasses. SHEEHYOpticians.com. Rhinebeck Artist Shops, professional picture framing and fine art materials, Rhinebeck New Paltz, and now at 793 Broadway in Kingston. RhinebeckArt.com. Colby Attorney Service, document filing, document and information retrieval, and other services, including legal publishing and corporate record searches. ColbyService.com. And Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Bob Berman is our guest today. Bob, this one came in via Twitter at WAMC Vox Pop, and it's from Lewis S. Please ask Bob Berman to comment about the theory of a Perseid meteor outburst this year, and then Jupiter effect? Question mark. With Twitter, you get a 140 characters, so
right.
It may be tough to elaborate. But do you get the question?
Yes. Jupiter effect means that comets that Jupiter can channel because of its supergravitational field. It's 317 times heavier than Earth, so it really calls the shots in the solar system and can channel things in our direction or also protect us from other stuff that would have otherwise hit us. So
right.
By Jupiter effect, he means a greater concentration. And it's true that some years we have and Peter Jenniskens, one of the great meteor experts, has tried to predict when we might get extra good concentrations of Perseid meteors, but he hasn't done a very good job of it. Some years, instead of the usual 1 a minute, you get closer to 2 a minute or 2.5 meteors a minute, and some years is just sort of ordinary. And what we now realize is that the stuff that fell off Comet Swift-Tuttle, the material, left concentrated streams. And when you go through them, it's sort of like a lawn sprinkler, that some of the water is more concentrated and some of it isn't. And when we, those years that we plow through a little bit of a narrow stream, we can, for an hour at a time or the whole shower, get a richer shower than usual.
Yeah.
But you'll even see this to a lesser effect if you watch the meteors next Thursday or Friday night. You'll see there'll be 5 and 10 minute periods where you have double the number. And then another 10-minute period can pass where you don't see any, and people are discouraged, and they say, oh, it's not happening.
Do we have the technology to map the denser areas?
Only after the fact, unfortunately.
Okay.
Because you can't see them. They're only the size of apple seeds, Ray. So there's no way to actually see them coming until they hit us.
All right, let's go back to the phones. And Ted in Pleasant Valley. Ted, you're on.
Hi. How's Bob and Ray doing today?
Well, we're hanging in there.
Okay. Hey, listen, Bob. I got a question. I read something in your book, Zoom, that said the galaxies really aren't moving, but they're getting farther apart. Am I reading that right, or am I understanding
well,
that
well,
right?
Well, yes or no. You're basically understanding. When it comes to the fastest motion of the universe, the Hubble flow, the Hubble constant, in other words, things moving 13 miles per second faster for every million light years farther they are, that's called the Hubble constant, that's not caused by the galaxies moving. That's caused by the empty space between them inflating. And we know that it may sound like, well, hey, come on, isn't this semantics? But it isn't, because if the galaxies had to move, that would mean mass is being accelerated and they'd be handcuffed by the rules that prevent objects from accelerating to the speed of light. But if it's just empty space that's inflating, then even something as heavy as a galaxy can go faster than the speed of light without violating Einstein's laws. And that's what we see, that there's a place where galaxies are receding at the speed of light that's located 13.8 billion light years away, and beyond that, where galaxies are going faster than the speed of light, where you don't even see them at all. However, that being said, within groups of galaxies, for example, our local group of about 30 galaxies, yes, then you do have the gravitational influence on one on the other, and there is actual motion between galaxies. For example, the nearest spiral galaxy, Andromeda, is coming toward us at 70 miles per second. That's not due to space inflating. That's just due to an actual interaction between our Milky Way galaxy and Andromeda. So you really have both happen, but the biggest, largest scale motion is not from the galaxies moving. It's from empty space inflating.
There you go.
That's a tough one for me to grab.
Yeah, for all of us.
Well, thanks, Ted.
Okay, thank you very much.
Appreciate the call.
Pleasure.
So Andromeda's heading our way. When will it hit?
We used to think 5 billion years from now, and now many are saying 2.5 or 3 billion years from now.
All right. Set your calendars. Let's go to John in Newburgh. John, you're on.
Hi. Jimmy Walker, the PGA champion, was showing his deep space pictures of galaxies way, way, way far away. Do you know roughly how far away they were?
I didn't see the picture you're talking about.
I did not see it either, although I did see Jimmy Walker 1.
They were incredible.
Didn't see them. So here's one that I got another question that I know something about, other than this photograph.
No. Well, there. Some of them showed like three galaxies in a close clump, but I don't know.
The biggest clump of three are what's called the Leo triplet. That might have been that. Just in the south part of Leo the Lion, near the star with the strange name Zasma. There's a Leo triplet of M66, M67, and the third one is, I think, NGC 2836. Those three galaxies are three bright galaxies really close together. So when you say three, it makes me think of those.
All right.
Okay, I was thinking they were like a billion light years away.
Well, once you get to a billion and more light years away, galaxies are so far that they look like little tiny blurs. You don't see any detail. They're not very good photographs anymore.
So it must be close.
Because you're not seeing, it's probably close that you're talking about.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, sure. John. We appreciate the call. Bob Berman is our guest, 800-348-2551. Michael in Middlefield, Mass. Michael, you're on.
Hi, thanks, Bob and Ray. First of all, I'd like to say I went with Bob to Alaska last year. We had four nights of great auroras, so that's wonderful. Yeah. But just to set the historical record, when you were speaking about quasars, I think the work that Anthony Hewish and Jocelyn Bell did was about pulsars.
He was talking about that during the break.
Tell him, Ray.
No, he mentioned it. He said,
and they called them LGMs because they first thought that this.
You're absolutely right, and it's a great catch. You know, I told Ray at the break, I said, you know, I started crediting Jocelyn Bell because I was thinking of neutron stars and pulsars. And then I had to switch gears there and switch to quasars. So good catch on your part. I caught the same thing, fortunately, before I finished my sentence. And by the way, while I'm correcting myself, I said the LEO triplet was M66 and M67. And as I'm thinking about it, I realize it's M65 and M66.
Right. Of course.
I just wanted to add that by the time they got the fourth pulsar, they realized that the odds of four separate alien civilizations trying to contact the Earth was pretty near zero, and they realized that it was a natural phenomenon.
Good for you, and thanks so much for coming to Alaska. Wasn't that a great trip?
I loved it. I still look at the photographs. So they're wonderful.
Fantastic.
Okay, clear skies to everybody. Thanks.
Thanks, Michael. We appreciate it. 800-348-2551. Ron in Sloanesville. Ron, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, by the way.
You're welcome.
I was inspired by a previous caller because I have a similar question concerning centrifugal force, but as applied to the Earth and global warming and, you know, the fact that the oceans are getting level is increasing, has the Earth's rotation started to slow down measurably?
Yes,
kind of relevant records have been taken?
Yes, it's slowing down, but for a different reason. See, actually, what should be affecting us is our increased weight. We're a ton heavier every hour, our planet Earth is, thanks to the impact of micrometeors that are always raining down on us. And that would change our rotation. In fact, it would do it the other way. It would speed us up. But we are slowing down. I'll tell you by how much. We are a day is 1 second longer after 700 centuries.
Oh, wow.
Every 700 centuries, we're a second longer. You think that's not much, but the centuries and the millennia and the millions of years actually add up.
Yeah.
And that has it significantly slows down our planet. But that's happening because the moon is leaving us. The moon is pulling on the oceans. You mentioned oceans. Moon's pulling on the oceans. That's what gives us our tides. The water's hitting the beaches, and that's causing a breaking motion with two effects. Slows Earth.
Yeah.
But the moon gains what we lose because we're attached. So the moon gains the energy, and it gains it by spiraling away from us. And every year, the moon is an inch and a half farther away, and the month is a little bit longer. So those two things are interlinked. Our Earth slowing down a second per 700 centuries, and the moon spiraling away by an inch and a half a year. The two are going together.
Ron, thanks a lot for the call. Over to Barry in Scotia, New York. Barry, you're on with Bob Berman.
Hi. I have the impression that we are losing track of time scales. That is, people talk about 700 centuries, and this is something we really can't grasp with our ordinary senses at all. Well, one of my questions was, however, the universe is expanding. What's to prevent us from thinking about the universe as slowly falling or very slow motion flying apart?
Well, aren't we flying apart? We are flying apart.
Is that the same thing as saying it's expanding?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, exactly right, because the distance between every galaxy and every other, except here in our local group where there's gravitational effects.
Right. Except expanding is a positive-sounding word, which makes us feel it's wonderful. We're getting bigger, whereas slowly falling or flying apart is a negative word. It sounds like things are coming apart, but it's the same thing. It's just depending on your way of looking at it.
That's right. It's a darn Obama administration.
Hey, now.
Right. Well, so, and the same thing goes with this. I mean, I was hearing, for example, the dinosaurs 65 million years ago, they disappeared. They're around for 135 million years. So if you subtract the total time that human beings have been on Earth, let's say 500,000 years to be really generous, that would have changed the amount of time dinosaurs were around from 65 million to 64.5 million. So I think we don't have any sense of the perspective when scientists talk about these things. You're good at math and you use this, but it doesn't make any sense. We think of things in normal scale, but that's not what you're talking about at all.
My brain now hurts, Barry. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Have a good one. Ouch, all that hurts. All right, let's try to find Steve up in Keene, New Hampshire. I hope his radio's turned down. Steve, are you there?
Yes, I am, and I'm sorry for the radio problem.
No problem, man. You're on with Bob Berman.
Okay, Bob, my question has to do with the ionization that occurs in the trails of the Perseids meteor shower. The reason I asked the question is I'm a radio amateur, and I work with others that bounce radio signals off these ionized trails. I'd like to know how long they last and whether they are frequent. I guess it's as frequent as the meteor, but perhaps you could talk a little bit about how they are able to bounce radio signals back to Earth.
Okay, I'll do the best I can. It sounds like this is more your field than mine, but absolutely. In fact, when we see a meteor next week in the sky, we're not actually seeing the meteor itself, because how can you see an apple seed-sized object that's 80 or 100 miles away? No matter how bright it is, you couldn't. What we're instead seeing is the ionization. In other words, the air right in front of and also surrounding that little apple seed is glowing due to ionization and continues glowing for a second or two.
You say that's 80 miles or so up?
That's right. Typically 60 to 100. And it's the ionization that even lets us see it. But you're right that also ionization allows bouncing radio signals. Now, when we do that on SLU, you know, the online observatory, and we do live programs, we get one feed from one of our partners who's doing just that. They're picking up radio waves bouncing off the meteors, and we're seeing them at a frequency much greater than the ones that you actually observe. So in other words, there are more. You asked about the frequency. There are more that we hear through ionization than we actually see.
Interesting. Steve, what are you running?
Oh, that's good to know. Good to know.
What are you running, 6 meters up there on Meteor Scatter?
No, not on a scanner. It's two-way radio.
No, I mean 6 meters?
We operate on 2 meters, 1.5 meters, and any frequency lower than that. In fact, if Bob could tell me what the best frequency would be, I would very much like to know that.
Oh, thanks. That's outside of my field. The best I can tell you is Jupiter's decametric signals. that's your field more
than
mine.
You're right about the 2 meters. 6 meters works too, Steve, so good luck.
Okay, great.
Thanks a lot. We appreciate it. And let's go over to, Susanna in Schenectady. You're on. Susanna.
Hi. I'm just calling in to share some information. I heard you talk about the auroras in the past, and someone wanted to know if you could hear them. And in the 70s, I worked as a fire lookout in Alaska outside of Fairbanks. That was supposed to be, and it was, a very good place to see the auroras.
It is.
The building I worked in was owned by the University of Alaska, and they did barium experiments with the auroras in the winter. So of course you couldn't see auroras in the summer. But I lived in a cabin in the winter, and I saw auroras all the time. I mean, it was a fabulous place to see them, and I did hear them.
Right. Now, was Neil Brown with you at the time at the University of Alaska? I think he was. Back then in the
70s. Well, I was working for the Bureau of Land Management, not for the university.
I see. Well, that's a question that I get a lot on these aurora tours I've been doing for 30 years, and I've spoken to aurora researchers on them. And the bottom line is, I believe the people like yourself who say that they hear them. We shouldn't be able to hear them because, number one, you don't get sounds that high up. As you know, the air is too thin. And secondly, anything that occurs like a meteor or a bright aurora, it would take too long for the sound to reach you, whereas people hear them simultaneously with the meteor or with the aurora. So we're convinced that, yes, you really are hearing them, but no, you're not hearing ordinary sounds. What you're hearing is some kind of electromagnetic effect that some people apparently can pick up. Because I've heard a number of Alaska people, and Ned House, who owns the big hardware store and goes camping in northern Alaska every year, who say that they hear them very distinctively as hisses and crackles and pops and things like that. And even though, and by the way, sensitive equipment that's been set up to detect these sounds have never detected any sounds, which is more proof that they're not real sounds. They're something else. But I believe you that you're hearing them.
Susanna, thanks a lot for the call. All right, we'll wrap up the program here with one that came in via email from Dawn. How can we reconcile the power of human consciousness, even with its limitations, given the magnitude of the cosmos? Does it mean that the cosmos is even ever more powerful? Is human consciousness a force, like we talk about other forces in nature?
I don't think anybody can answer that. You know.
Well, you have 45 seconds to do just that.
Lenz and I see, and this is not even an original thought, that the universe and consciousness are correlative. In other words, they're part of the same kit and caboodle. And whether you then further categorize that as an energy, as a force, as being infinite, as being eternal, you can take that and run with that in a lot of different directions. But you start off with, the power seems limitless and the scope of consciousness seems limitless.
Well, Bob Berman, that's about where we'll have to wrap it up. And good luck with the Perseid meteor shower next week.
Thanks.
Hope you see them.
I hope everybody that we get good weather. And if it's clear, not hazy, if it's dry, that's your night. In other words, you get a choice of two nights, Thursday and Friday. Pick the night that's drier.
And stay up late.
Yeah.
All right. Bob Berman, thanks again. Support comes from Curtis Lumber, providing home improvement products and advice to homeowners and contractors, supporting local communities for over a century. CurtisLumber.com. The University at Albany Theater Program, providing individualized education in a 5-theater facility, working to train theater professionals for the 21st century, albany.edu/theater. Agricultural Stewardship Association, helping people conserve farmland in the Upper Hudson Valley. We conserve good farmland for good forever, agstewardship.org. And Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany, Dr. Tom Denham, providing individual career guidance, testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume and cover letter writing, Careers in Transition, LLC.com. Thanks again to Bob Berman for being here. Thanks to our engineer, Jordan Taylor. Your calls were answered by Colleen O'Connell today. Did a great job. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Well, today is Thursday. That makes tomorrow a Friday. That makes tomorrow a Food Friday. And that's always a good thing. Stay tuned now for news.